All right, good morning, and you're listening to Radio Naturopath here at WHUS 91.7 FM, and we have a very exciting show for you today. Today, we welcome Michelle Allison to Radio Naturopath. Michelle is a licensed marriage and family therapist practicing in Storrs, Mansfield, Connecticut. She graduated from the University of Connecticut and has been in practice for over 20 years. She sees clients from their tween years into their golden years. She specializes in helping people with relationship issues, depression, and especially transgender issues. She also helps people with many other issues, such as ADHD, anxiety, behavioral issues, substance abuse, and many more. We're very happy to have you on the show today, Michelle. Welcome.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
I'm so excited to have you here. So we'll get right into it. We have so many things that we would love to talk about with you. So I'll get you going. So the first question we want to ask you is about transgenderism. Why now? And how common is it?
Well, it's certainly something that people are a lot more aware of than they used to be. And when these kinds of things happen, when things show up in the media and in the public consciousness, the idea is this some sort of fad, and why didn't we hear about this 10 or 20 years ago? And something like transgenderism, like a lot of other things that show up, it's clearly been around, but the culture is now much more welcoming. And that climate, as climate gets better, people who would have remained, you know, closeted or unwilling to express decide to come forward. So it's a very affirming environment. Everyone tells me you couldn't have picked a better time to have a transition than now, and I think I would have to agree with that. But it's not like it was never there. It's just it's only now being recognized as something we should pay attention to.
It's very interesting in how the climate has changed. Do you think that there's something about the social climate now that has made it more common for people to come out, speak about it, and that it's really a big thing in the media now?
Well, in terms of, I mean, I'm old enough to have remembered the 60s well. So for me, it starts with, you know, race and civil rights, and then it moves into the women's movement and sexual liberation. It also shifts into Stonewall and gay and lesbian rights. And now transgender is kind of just seems to me the latest iteration of, you know, individuals finding ways to express a more authentic sense of self. And it's just we're kind of, and who knows what will come next, but I think the transgender phenomenon, as it were, is probably the latest version of what something that's been going on for quite some time.
I think it's great that I think that's great that we're heading towards a level of more acceptance of diversity. And something that Ron and I have talked about a lot is the millennial generation. They seem to be way ahead of it. I mean, this is a generalization, but they seem to be way ahead of the older generations in terms of diversity and acceptance of all kinds of things. Of ethnic fluidity is a big term to them, ethnic fluidity, gender fluidity, sexual fluidity. You know, I had a young millennial person say to me, you know, there's not just two genders, because he's a big believer in gender fluidity. So it's very interesting that we're in this time.
Well, they've evolved.
I guess so.
I think that's what it really is, because it's all of a sudden there's this enormous change in acceptance where there was never before.
And they have a paradigm of acceptance. They have a paradigm of fluidity. So I agree with you. It's a wonderful time.
I mean, I was speaking with someone who works at Res Life here at this university, and they talked about what it was like for them socially in terms of, you know, who would they associate with, and they tend to stay often with Res Life people because the rest of the world, from their point of view, seems a little bit clueless, whereas they're tuned in to people, young adults and so forth. And for them, people in residential life working in the university community, it's inevitable that you would have a more accepting, open way of looking at things and be much more comfortable with, you know, such a variety of expressions. And this is some of what's going on politically as well, where, you know, this ongoing argument of, you know, tradition versus something new and more diverse. And you know, the byplay around that is really kind of intriguing. So I think transgender people and their interests and their experience is just one kind of small piece of a larger picture. I mean, it seems way more important if you're transgender, but I try to look at the big picture because it's part of a larger dynamic, I think.
That's great. So we have so many questions, and there's a lot of things that you wanted to bring to light here. So next thing I'll ask you about is people don't always know how to act in the presence of a transgender person. The things that transgender people worry about, passing, being clocked, misgendering. Can you speak to that?
Well, let me just say that for a lot of the people that in my social circle or even in my professional circle, they're almost inevitably here in Connecticut politically progressive. That is to say, they would be in favor of all the appropriate, you know, rules and regulations. But they don't they haven't had an in-person experience with a transgender person. So it's, you know, they often say, whoa, this is really quite remarkable. And then I actually am talking and being with someone who represents something I've read about, heard about. So it's like everything else. If you have if you stay in your own particular tribe, then you don't learn much about the people on the other side of the river. So a lot of it is just education. Most people are exceptionally well-intentioned, but they don't know what the rules are. And who's going to explain it to them? I mean, I guess I will to some extent today.
Yes, please.
That's good.
So, you know, one of the big things is pronouns. I mean, a transgender person, depending on what they bring to, you know, their situation, wants to have their new gender identity affirmed. So they often would have an appropriate name. I mean, you'd have your name change or you ask to be called something even if you don't make the legal name change. And the pronoun issue is big. People want to be referred to by the appropriate pronouns. And they certainly would like to not be misgendered. They would not like to be called by their old name if they're asking you to use a new name. And they'd like you to use the preferred pronouns depending on how, and everyone gets to choose their preferred pronouns. But I think it's useful to know that it isn't totally binary. In other words, it isn't just male to female transgender people and female to male. There's also a continuum, and there's a number of people who professionally we call them gender nonconforming. They tend to identify themselves as gender queer. And for these folks, they don't even want the male or the female pronouns, so they go with they, their, them. And then we have grammarians who struggle, and also it is an odd usage to refer, if I would refer, well, I was just with Fran Storch and they told me. It's like, you know, Fran has cloned herself. And so people struggle with that. And if they make a mistake, I mean, if it's up to the transgender person to decide how reasonable and lenient you want to be. I'm very lenient because, you know, it's all force of habit. I even misgender myself, referring to myself as that guy, and then I catch myself. I have trouble signing Michelle. It's like something about the E and the two L's, my left hand, which has been signing my other name, which was Michael. Not a very imaginative shift. So I try to be forgiving, understanding that if people make a good faith effort, as opposed to, I'm going to dig in my heels, I'm not going to do what you want, I'm not going to give you what you ask for because it rubs me the wrong way and I can irritate you by deliberately not doing something. So I think that's, but you really have to ask, what do you prefer? How should I mean, just you have to ask the person and hopefully the person will be congenial enough to be helpful to you. I mean, I always try and be helpful because the goal is to make everybody have a good experience with me, the transgender person, and then that will generalize to their attitudes about everyone. And plus, you know, we'll all be more relaxed. And so, I mean, I volunteer that I'm transgender. People are looking at me, wondering. I mean, I'm thinking, this is radio. You're looking at me now. I think I look pretty decent. But on the radio, I may sound pretty male. And on the phone, I'm misgendered incessantly. Sometimes I correct people, and sometimes I just don't even bother. So, you know, there you are going to get misgendered depending on how hard you work to appear in the gender you want to appear in. And then if you're, you know, gender nonconforming, you're just sort of appearing the way you want to. You've invented an identity, and people look at you and, well, maybe back and forth, a kind of androgynous, non-specific gender look. So I think the cis population has to just accept that they don't really have all the answers and wait to get educated. And I hope the transgender folks they run into will be kind toward them, because that would be a good thing.
And asking to be educated is that's a reasonable thing.
Right.
And the worst that can happen is that person is not going to be as helpful and friendly to you. But that's a risk that you can take. But it's probably a risk that's worthwhile taking. If you're coming from a kind place and a place where I'm interested in connecting with you, and I say, I want to say the right thing, so please share with me, how shall I address you and what
most people
what are your
have
pronouns?
Been very kind toward me.
Yeah.
They said, gee, I really don't know. I hope don't give. I mean, there was a time when I was legally still, you know, as a male name, male identity. I'd be, you know, appearing, presenting, and I'd be handing them, a license or a credit card, and they'd be looking at that, and then they'd be going, right, transgender. That's what's going on here. It's going to be okay. And they go, thank you, because I didn't want to cause offense, but I didn't really know what the heck to do. And how would they?
Right. What happens when you're in public and someone misidentifies you? How do you handle that?
Well, my experience, I have not yet had that unpleasant experience of someone saying, hey, man, you're a dude. But that is likely in my future, maybe.
People should really mind their manners.
But they don't. They don't mind their manners even
well,
with...
But I do have people, I mean, I'm in a, you know, I associate with transgender folks and I have clients who are transgender. So some people do get clocked, that's the word. And it doesn't always have to be that outrageous. But the idea of people looking at you and going, well... what the heck's going on there? And some transgender people terribly much worry about being not passing. And, you know, not everyone can be a convincing version of the gender they identify with. And if you see, you go to a conference where there's a lot of different transgender folks there, the varieties of visual expression, how much care they take in dressing, hair, makeup, no makeup, all this and all that, and I'm talking about, you know, trans women. Trans men are a little more, it's a little easier sometimes depending on what God gave you and what kind of medical interventions you have to be passable. But I encourage people, trans people, to not become fixated on passing, but more on expression. So the idea is that you express a gender identity of your own choosing, and you do this in a way that feels comfortable for you. And when you're comfortable in your own skin, you tend to do better in public, you're less tense, you telegraph, less anxiety. And that's what, you know, going through a process of transition, getting support, talking to other trans people, having a therapist, any number of things can help you with. So, but for those in the audience who are, I mean, it would be not, you know, don't yell stuff at people. The HUS listener is not going to be yelling stuff at people, you know.
We're in a bubble here, too, so it's going to be far more unlikely here would be in other parts of the country.
Mansfield is kind of a bubble.
Yes, it is.
Connecticut is kind of a bubble.
Yep.
Yeah, pretty much.
Well, it has its moments.
But there's places in Connecticut where, you know, I'm not really sure I would feel totally safe, but... I'm not sure a single woman alone would feel totally safe there either.
That's right.
Right.
But, you know, let me just say a couple of things about, you know, the bathroom issue, because that's sort of a big political hot potato.
Oh, and, boy, is it. Yeah.
Well, almost everybody goes, you've got to be kidding. I guess what I'd like the regular public to know is that going into the bathroom is a source of tremendous anxiety for a transgender, non-gender conforming person. I mean, if you're thinking these people are a threat to you, if you could only know how threatened and anxious they feel.
Oh God, I would think so.
Going in there wondering what on earth is going to happen to me.
Sure.
And so I know individuals who can't figure out any bathroom they can comfortably go into. They're kind of like your kids, you know, who refuse to, you know, go to the bathroom at high school. They wait till they come home. It's just too much exposure.
You know, but the thing is, I had that in high school because I was worried about going into the boys' bathroom and coming out without having been accosted by a bully in the bathroom. And that's kind of common.
I mean, I can tell you that the first time I went into a women's bathroom, which was at the Rave Cinemas in Manchester while watching some opera, I spent the whole first act, you know, being anxious about how this is going to go. You know, I didn't think I was going to have any physical threat, but what if some woman, because that's who would be in there, took a look at me, found me weird and upsetting, and called the management, and I had some sort of incident. So,
Sure. I could.
Now,
see
none
that.
Of that happened. I mean, you know, the women in there were trying to figure out how to make the towel machine work. But, you know, you know, there's a lot of anxiety around coming out, wherever you come out and who you come out to, appearing in public, going anywhere and everywhere. And the idea, I mean, if there is someone who is going to do damage, you know, that's just got nothing to do with the transgender population. I mean, transgender folks, all they can do just to kind of keep their lives together and go forward. So I hope that's of some reassurance. But put, you know, this is empathy, which is, isn't that about where you put yourself in the shoes of another person? So just imagine you're transitioning, you don't look that right necessarily, you don't know what the hell you're doing, and you go out in public, you go to the grocery store, you go to a bathroom, and you present yourself to the world, how would you feel? You know, it's like a bigger version of being in public with your fly unzipped. It's just like very exposed. Right? So maybe that would be of some help. I know I put on my list of things. I did want to just give people, without being overly scholarly or pedantic, just some sense of the notion that transgenderism, or what we call gender dysphoria, has scientific and medical validity. So I'm hoping most people at this point know that to be transgender is to have your felt sense of gender identity at variance with your birth, you know, physiology. And this is a brain-based, physiological, neurobiological condition. It's not a personality deficiency or some aberrant behavior, although I'm not saying there aren't people here and there who would go in that direction. But it's not something you're born with, but it's something that, according to the research I've looked at, happens in utero. It's a very complicated process to decide, for the body to decide what the brain gender centers are like. I mean, the genitalia and all of that, that's kind of what you get. But there's opportunities for things to go awry. And when it does go awry, then you end up with this mismatch between your brain's sense of what your gender is and your body's, you know, what it looks like. And then as this bumps into the reality of, you know, you feeling like you're a boy or a girl or something in the middle, and then you're corrected by your parents or you get all the social cues about what's acceptable and what isn't, then you realize, well, I can't really be who I feel like I can be. I have to do something else. And so the ongoing experience of things not lining up and it presenting all kinds of social problems is been called gender dysphoria. It's in the DSM, which is this big book of, you know, psychiatric disorders. And it's very important that it's in there because it gives it a legitimacy. And it doesn't say it's a problem with the person. They don't have a mental health problem. They have a problem in that just biologically and mentally things don't line up. And then you get anxious, you get depressed, you don't feel as comfortable as you might. So this is recognized by the AMA, the American Psychiatric Association, American Psychological Association, Centers for Medicare. Most of the medical interventions are reimbursable. And when you go to get medical treatment, you're given this code for gender dysphoria, and that makes it legitimate. And I can say for myself that when I'm a mental health professional, it's amazing, I was so blind, but when I actually realized, oh, gender dysphoria, brain-based, I'm not some sort of bizarre individual, I've got this kind of condition that just sort of happened, that was quite relieving to me because people of my cohort, that is to say the older transgender person who did not have the benefits of a more open and accepting society in, 1957, you live with a lot of shame and that's significant. And there are generational differences. The younger a person is, the more comfortable they're going to be with all this. They will have difficulties because no world is perfect, but they do much better. It happens more easily, more comfortably. Older folks have a lot of history, a lot of complexities to their lives. It makes it much harder to transition as you get older. Totally doable if you want to do it, and it is done, but it's more difficult. I'll shut up.
So speaking of which, when did you the discovery or the leap? I don't know what to call it.
Well, really, at age 73, less than a year ago.
Really?
Yes, that soon. It's kind of a shock.
Wow.
It is bizarre. And I was a very functional person. I had my issues, but, I think I performed pretty well as a... I was married. I have two children. Very affirming family around all this, but I had so much. I was just so conditioned to believe that this was a really bad thing. That whatever feelings I were having were not acceptable, not legitimate. Lots and lots of shame. I could write several volumes on shame, and it just took. A lot of time for things to kind of finally break open. In fact, I owe my 21-year-old daughter a vote of thanks. I'm sure she won't mind me saying this publicly, that she outed me, kind of discovered some cross-dressing stuff while she was rooting around for a gift bag and kind of challenged me to face up to this I had to take her seriously. So,
wow, good for her.
So that little breakthrough kind of just pushed me over the edge. And, once I kind of figured it out and I said, if I accept this and go forward with it, I'm going to feel so much better, then it was relatively easy for me to make a transition. And, I'm fortunate. I'm white. I'm middle class. I'm professional. I'm self-employed. I don't have young children. That makes it easier. I mean, if you are of a minority, if you are poor, it's a much harder road. And that's why people kind of resent Caitlyn Jenner, because they say, she's Hollywood. She's got plenty of big bucks. So she had her struggles, I'm sure, but she doesn't have the struggles of an African-American transgender person living in a dangerous neighborhood with few resources. I mean, let's get
right.
real about
there's
that, folks.
There's a big difference there. Yeah.
So that's the part. Those transgender people are ones that I worry about because... even your insurance matters. I mean, Husky is supposed to pay for stuff, but Husky reimbursement little low. You end up being kind of low on the list. Hard to find providers. so forth.
Yes, it's true. Yeah. By the way, you had said there's a DSM code for gender dysphoria, and I wanted to know if there's an ICD-10 code, and there is.
F41.1, right?
I have F64.1.
Okay,
but
sorry.
Yeah, that's
I got
okay.
That wrong.
That's all right, but you're more accustomed to the DSM codes. But I wanted to see, but that means that you can go to a PCP or some other kind of doctor.
Yes, you can go anywhere and ask for, and maybe we should say a little bit about, you know, what the pathway toward a transition can be. And
yes.
So I guess what I want to emphasize is that it's totally individual. There's no anything you have to do or not do. You figure out what's right for you, and then you accomplish that as best you can. So the core medical intervention that happens first usually is some kind of hormone replacement therapy. That's done by an endocrinologist. So, you know, that has different effects for what, depending on which gender you start with. And then, you know, there are various surgical interventions, you know, and then top surgery, chest, et cetera, and then bottom surgery, which is more genitally oriented. And those are, you know, much more dramatic. And it's all kind of set forth in a rather methodical, organized way. So, because the idea is the medical community is terribly worried that people will have surgeries and interventions that they'll regret or that are not clinically appropriate. So as a mental health professional, you know, not as a transgender person, but as a mental health professional, I'm required to provide letters and documentation to medical providers to the effect of this person knows what they're doing, their gender dysphoria is legitimate, it's persistent, it's been around, it's across many domains, and you're not going to have to worry about this person coming back and hitting you with some complaint that you inappropriately treated them. So the medical community is variable. Some are more conservative than others, and there aren't as many providers, I think, as would be useful, because as there's kind of this explosion of transgender transitions, you know, the medical community is playing catch up. So it takes a while to get an appointment, takes a while to get seen. You have to be patient. But I tell people it's a good thing, because you really don't want to rush into this. You really want to make sure you know what you're doing. And time and experience are the things that are going to help you with that. But I have to write a letter, even to get hormone treatment, I have to write a letter saying this person is, you know, mentally stable, doesn't have any untreated, unaddressed issues. And for the surgeries, those require even more complex and thoughtful letters with more documentation. And this is all set forward in what's called the Standards of Care from the World Professional Association for Transgender Health, WPATH for short. These are voluntary guidelines. Some physicians ask for more, but there's no physicians going to ask for less. And this is, you know, the compilation of wisdom over the last 50 years of treating these people. So the medical community has the resources to handle this. It's just a matter of the physicians and other providers in any particular area deciding they want to show an interest.
You have to present mental stability, because doesn't depression come along with gender dysphoria?
Well, yeah, that's an interesting point. What I like to say is the person has no co-occurring mental health disorders beyond their gender dysphoria. In other words, you're allowed to be grumpy and irritable and depressed and anxious around your gender dysphoria, but, you know, sometimes people have stuff that is not totally gender dysphoria, but you're right. You have to tease out, okay, how much of this is, if their gender dysphoria was addressed, would go away, how much would not? I mean, we can pretty much sure that, you know, treatment for gender dysphoria isn't going to help your ADHD.
That's right.
Right.
Or your bipolar disorder.
Or your bipolar or your thought disorder.
Right.
And
you're,
I think, actually those are the ones they're worried about. But, you know, someone who had a lot of major depression was easily triggered to, you know, suicidality and so forth. Well, maybe you have having a transition is a big thing. It can be upsetting. It can be frustrating. It can be scary. So people probably do. That's why I know this sounds totally self-serving, but I mean, if you're getting a divorce, you know, get a therapist. It'll be good for you. if you're having a gender transition, don't just get a therapist so you can get the letter. Get a therapist so you have some you have some professional support through something that is really quite a significant thing. I mean, hey, I have a therapist, and it's worked nicely for me.
I think it's a good idea to get a therapist anyway.
Yeah. Well,
in general.
Well, right. not for grocery shopping, probably, unless you have a lot of OCD. But
there you go. And the occasional tune-up, you know, you need the occasional
But
tune-up.
I do think that this is the kind of thing where, but, you know, transgender folks are like everybody else. Some think therapy is really very helpful, and others kind of resent having to do it and think they know better. But I do think you should not have to have this impossibly high bar. You know, it's like so many things where you can be a pretty lousy parent, and then when DCF shows up at your door, you know, suddenly you have this incredible gold standard of parenting. Meanwhile, there's 100 people, you know, that nobody knows about that are continuing to do marginal parenting. And the bar should not be unreasonable. Otherwise, you're just punishing people and further stigmatizing, you know, mental health problems. You know, that's an issue.
So I have a question for you. Do you have to go through the therapy that you provide in order to transition?
You have to get the appropriate letters to give to your medical providers. You know, that's the only requirements. I don't think people should be required to have therapy, but the medical community says we want mental health professionals to evaluate you because we don't feel competent to do that. And then once we have that evaluative process in place, that's all. So they're not requiring that. The standards of care say you need a letter for this, two letters for that. You know, it's all set out.
And the letters must come from medical providers.
They must come from licensed, you know, mental health professionals.
Okay.
But and you don't have to have, I mean, I'm a rare bird being a mental health professional who happens to be transgender. I mean, that's, you know, there's many competent people here and elsewhere. I mean,
there are, that's such an asset to you because you're going to make you very popular.
Well, yes and no. I mean, I don't think it's a detriment, but I'm just saying that there's, for example, let's talk a little bit about what to do for kids.
Yes.
How are we doing time-wise?
We've got another half hour.
Okay. Well, I'm thinking that maybe there's a parent or two whose child is making some kind of rumblings around this, and what on earth should they be thinking about as parents? So again, the community has something to say, and I think it's pretty sensible. I mean, we all know that various children, quite early in life, you know, do cross-gender behaviors. You know, they say, I'm a boy, I'm a girl, they play with this, they don't play with that, they want to dress, they want to not dress. And, you know, some of that is just interesting exploration, and some of it is early expressions of, you know, gender identity. Lots of transgender folks will tell you, I'm either my family remembers or I remember, you know, feeling like this, not feeling like that. You know, others may not feel much of anything until puberty. But the rule of thumb is just let your kid do what they would like. If they would like to say, I'm a boy, let them say that. If they would like to associate with this or that child and play this or that activity, just let them do that. Just let them go where they will. None of this is going to lead to anything problematic, and see where that plays out. It wouldn't be the worst idea to maybe check in with a gender experienced therapist just to kind of get a little information along these lines. But, you know, really benign neglect is pretty much what you do until puberty. At puberty is where the rubber hits the road. And at this point, people with significant gender dysphoria are really going to start to experience something fairly significant because, you know, sexuality is blooming. And again, that is where you would certainly be looking at interventions depending on where your child is and what they think they want to do.
again, clarification in a family therapy setting seems like would be very helpful. But if the child and the family decide they want an initial medical intervention, then you find in this state, the Connecticut Children's Medical Center has a clinic and a very excellent endocrinologist. And so you go there, and the first intervention is pubertal blockers. And what this does is this just sort of arrests the puberty at the moment and just kind of puts things in neutral and gives the child an opportunity to see what happens and see how they feel. And then, you know, after 3 or 4 years, if they're still feeling, yeah, I feel very strongly that I have something I want to do around this, then they can start with informed consent and with the agreement of their parents, they can start, you know, the cross-gender hormones. At 18, when you're, you know, legally of age and able to give your own informed consent, at that point you have the legal power to decide what, if anything, you want to do. Now, you don't have to have done anything early. You can wait as long as you want. You can wait till 73 if you feel like it. but I'm just saying, if that's what's possible and what the medical standards kind of allow for. But you see, again, it's drawing things out, giving everybody a chance to let things settle, letting the developmental process unfold kind of over time, not being impulsive or reactive, just kind of quietly letting things play out. And that can work pretty well. I mean, you know, you have to deal with schools. You need to see where your school is at culturally. Most schools are pretty good, but some are better than others. Parents need to be advocates. They need to go in and talk to staff and say, this is what's going on for my kid, and I hope that, you know, you will be affirming and let him or her or them have the right pronouns and the right name. I hope you'll be attentive to the cultural dynamics in the hallways and in the lunchroom so that, and I think schools around here are pretty attentive to these kinds of issues, but they need to know. In other words, you need to kind of go in proactively and say, look, this is what's happening. Over the summer, my child started to say and do these kinds of things, and so they're going to show up in your building, and this is what it's going to look like. And that way, everybody can kind of come together and have a more team-oriented, collaborative approach, because there's too many pieces of this for any one person to get a grip. You know, if you need to pull out the heavy legal guns, there's plenty of ammunition for that. But it's always good to, you know, try and get people to do the right thing, because most of the time they will if you can help them understand what that is. And again, if you're working with a professional, they also can help you with that, because the professional can call the school up and say, well, you know, I'm working with this family, and you go, thank God, and what's going on, and you tell them. And it's like anything else with a child-related problem when you're interfacing with the school. You're just trying to, you know, help the school understand what they need to do, reassure the school that this is, you know, that these are thoughtful, well-intentioned people, and lower their anxiety. Because schools are kind of worried that they're pretty worried about getting it wrong. So that's probably a good thing.
Especially in Mansfield. And in Mansfield, you're going to have a lot of support, I would guess.
For the most part. But you can't control everything. There's,
no.
I think at the staff level and the teacher level, things will be good. But, you know, there could be a few kids in the hallway who are going to give you a hard time. Or cyberbullying. I mean, you wouldn't believe the stuff that gets said.
Right.
Oh, sure.
Cyberbullying, it's just something that we never had to deal with, and it's a real gender issues or not.
Anything.
Huge
issue. I mean, I've had kids with depressive issues, suicidal experience, and, you know, people on social media saying, hey, you should have, too bad you didn't kill yourself.
Horrible.
Outrageous.
That's just horrible.
Outrageous.
Well, the thing about social media is you can say and do what you want. It's the between email and text and social media in general, you have this level of anonymity that, you know, where you would say and do things that you might not do if you were with
the point
person.
Is that, you know, you do the best you can, and hopefully your child will share with you, yes, some bad stuff is happening, and you do what you can with that. And then maybe you say to your child, maybe this is a social media you want to stay away from.
Right.
Maybe this
right.
is a
exactly.
maybe this is a toxic environment that's going to just not do you any good whatsoever.
Because you don't need to be there.
No.
But, you know, but it's part of the milieu for certain kids. So,
it's,
you know, it's
definitely the culture and, yeah. So,
but, you know, you do, we all do the best we can. I mean, in an open society, there's always going to be opportunities for bad actors. This is just the way it is.
So it's would you
true.
Say that, this is something that is the awareness, comes through more so around puberty than any other time?
I think, I mean, at puberty, kids are going to have powerful experiences. Whether they're going to share them is another matter. They're not all going to share them. They may not all feel that the family environment is accepting. They may not feel that the peer environment is accepting. But, you know, females who enter menses are often going to have dramatic emotional reactions. Oh, my God. This is not
sure.
what I want.
Right.
Females who wish to kind of be more androgynous have a particular postural problem. They hunch their shoulders over to hide their chest. Mm-hmm. And then they, over years, develop all these musculoskeletal
really?
Anomalies. Yes.
Wow.
You know, and so... You know, the idea, I mean, it's why chest surgery is an important intervention often for,
right.
but, you know, so these kinds of things start to, and you hear stories, I wore loose clothing, I was going to the gym, was horrendous. All of these kinds of places where you, and, you know, bathrooms, of course, as well, but just being exposed, you know, having yourself not look the way you're, quote, supposed to look, and then having to show up in a building with hundreds of other kids, even if the staff is affirming, is still asking a lot. It requires a lot of coherent sense of self. And, you know, who has that at age 14?
No, right.
Right. And the immature adolescent child is about as, they're just not kind.
Well, adolescence is a real difficult time, and everyone can, you know, lots of people reflect on, oh, my God, adolescence was a horrendous time. Well, if you're gay or lesbian or transgender, you know, it's even more complicated.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just, I mean, I guess the thing to remember is that if you talk to a student, we were talking earlier about the acceptance of the younger cohort, they just use the word queer. I mean, they just lump everybody together. If you have a young person, articulate young person, they'll say, well, in my school, we organized all the queer students, and we had this organization, and we served, my goal is to serve queer students. And that's just, everything gets all lumped together.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably a good thing. So, you know, the kids are, for the most part, able to be organized and affirming. That was an off-mic cough. Sorry about that. and so you have to do the best you can. And I feel pretty optimistic about, I mean, if someone in this town, for example, I realize you're listening, it goes beyond Mansfield, but I think MMS and E.O. Smith will do a very good job. I mean, I'm going over to E.O. Smith next week just to meet with my old friends there. And, you know, just help them and offer myself and give them any support and resources they may need.
Yeah.
And they're looking for, you know, they're anxious to have resources and have help with that.
So one of the things that you had talked about here is that they're actually, when transitioning from one gender to the other, that there's differences in transitioning male to female versus female to male. Can you speak to that?
Well, it's, I guess, kind of obvious once you think about it. I mean, in other words, the hormones do different things. The surgeries are different. There's even some cultural differences.
That's, yeah, one of the things I'm interested in, yeah.
Well,
I don't know. Sometimes it's hard to say which is more challenging. I mean, are men going to accept women who transition to a male identity? And the reports I get from the individuals I've met is, for the most part, pretty darn good. I mean, they seem to have as reasonable a transition as not. But some things, like if they take hormones, they'll have a deepening voice and they'll have facial and body hair. Mm-hmm. So that helps. But they really can't disguise the chest without some sort of surgical intervention, yeah. unless they're just very slight to begin with. You know, they may be a little shorter than the average man. But they often have a lot of initial anxiety about being in male restrooms where they are concerned that, you know, males might approach them aggressively and so forth. So there's that piece. I mean, for males to females, we have the whole idea of what does it mean to be a man and being manly. And you wouldn't want to be feminine because that would be a terrible thing. So you have to consider whether you can tolerate, you know, some kind of negative reaction about being feminine. I have a lot of male clients. And that's true. They're therapy clients. But, you know, these are often blue-collar people. They're not just highly educated, you know, intellectuals. These folks have been very accepting of my transition. And I worried a lot about that. Oh, my God, what are people going to think? It's going to be way too weird. The people who couldn't handle it, a 12-year-old, a middle-aged woman, and then maybe a few others I don't really know about. But I think there are, you know, there's the medical and hormonal differences, but you still have the same thing about, is it okay? Are you going to get accepted? And I do think that in some groups, there's hardly any female to males. You get a bit more gender queer, gender nonconforming, where people start out as thinking they're lesbians. And then as they work through that, then they decide that, no, that's not quite it. I've seen that. I do have to cough. But I have seen that. I've seen trans women who start out as gay men and move through that as well. And there's also kind of the difference between orientation. I mean, you can have a different gender identity. For example, you could be a trans woman. You could be interested in men as sexual partners. You could be interested in women.
Right.
I guess you could be interested in both.
Right.
So they're two different things.
That gender identity and sexual identity are not,
right.
not the same thing.
Gender identity is who you think you are, and orientation is who you'd like to be with, who you're attracted to.
Right.
So you get a lot of mixing and matching going
yeah.
on because
yeah.
they don't always line up.
And the beautiful thing that I've seen is, and I actually have had in the younger generation, they're very accepting. Well, there's a thread anyway of fluidity.
Well, I'm thinking of people I know, either professionally or otherwise, who have cis partners.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, one trans woman I knew. When she broke up with her girlfriend said, you know, you weren't a very good girlfriend to me. And I just thought that was kind of charming. You know, it was the gender stuff was not what was going on. It was something totally else.
Yeah, it's just there. You weren't a good partner. Right. Yeah. And there are people who they're married. They have a heterosexual marriage. And one of the people transitions and they stay married.
Yes, you see that as well.
Yeah.
And I am impressed. I mean, I think what there's certainly some people stay married. I've been at support groups where people have brought their spouses or their significant others. There's also people who don't fully transition. In other words, they will take a they'll have a kind of a semi-transition
where they'll be out to their family and in certain selected social places, but they would not be out at work, and they might not be out in the community, and they might not be out to certain elements of their extended family. Mm. And I think everyone, I mean, sometimes I have to squelch my own narrative, which, I mean, for me, being totally out is completely the way to go. But you have to be respectful of people's understandings of what feels comfortable for them and what's doable. I mean, if you're a 40-year-old person married with children, you know, it is not necessarily the easiest thing to do, and you might want to, you know, consider the broader range of factors before you rush into it. And you know, sometimes when a person undergoes a transition, those who are unhappy say this person is being very selfish.
Aww.
Well, I mean, the fine line, I mean, if someone decides to get a divorce and, you know, it impacts children, which it does, are they being selfish? So these are issues that go across the board. Whenever you make an important life decision and you're embedded with family and other people, it's going to reverberate and they may not be happy with the outcome.
It's true.
So it has to do with how much value you place on being your autonomous, authentic self versus being respectful and considerate of other people's feelings and emotions. You have to work that out.
And on the other hand, if you're dysphoric because you're not expressing your gender, your preferred gender, and you're unhappy and that's depressing you, the fact that you're not being your authentic self affects how available you are to others. If you can be a lot happier when you're actually expressing, it might turn out that you are able to be more selfless.
I would hope. I mean, I think a cranky, depressed, anxious, you know, dysphoric partner or parent is probably not the greatest thing in the world. Yeah.
It's true. So it's one of those things. That's why I'm having a real struggle with the word selfish. We live in New England, and New England started out as the Puritans started out in New England. And so there's a very strong work ethic here. There's that term that's attributed to it, an honorable woman. An honorable woman has quiet strength. And that level of quiet strength, that's like an elevated term. I am not a quiet strength person.
No, I've noticed
strength.
That. You.
Yeah. Yeah, I almost resent. I mean, if you have quiet strength and that's a beautiful thing too, I think it's wonderful. But I feel like that dishonors those of us who are not quietly strong.
Right, and you know, there's to try and find ways to have, you know, I mean, diversity that we've been talking about should mean that the Puritan with quiet strength should be validated as well.
Good point.
I mean, we're so at odds with each other these days culturally, which is really discouraging. So some kind of, you know, common wheel, some sort of common thread that we could, you know, all find. So if you accept yourself and you feel accepted, then you'll be less irritated, less strident, less, you know, critical.
But one of the things is that people use that term selfish, and they use it as an epithet and a dart, and they, you're selfish.
Well, one person's selfishness is another person's authentic expression.
Exactly, right.
And
you have to be selfish to an extent so that you can live. It's the whole, you know, analogy of the being on the airplane. You have to have your own oxygen before you can help other people.
But I think that's kind of what's inevitably going to happen.
So, all right. And so there is another, there's another piece there that you talked about touching on, and that's religion. That through various religions, there's varying levels of tolerance and acceptance.
Right. And this, of course, is not, I mean, the transgender piece is a small element of, you know, it's very hard to argue with a theologically held position, because this is a belief system, not a rationally arrived at situation. So, you know, as a former student of religion back in the good old days, I'm pretty well aware of, you know, how religion works. I would just hope that, you know, we know all kinds of intolerance and judgmental behavior goes on in the name of religion. And it's unfortunate. I'm not aware of where the Bible particularly speaks to transgender, but it certainly has something to say about homosexuality.
Yes.
But, I mean, if someone believes that any particular book is the literally revealed word of a divine entity, then it's going to be pretty hard to rebut that. And in this culture, we're trying to argue for, you know, pluralism and, you know, no predominance of any particular theology over any other. So, you know, there's been some interesting writings around the place that white Christian America is going, the idea that it's becoming a minority, and that this accepted that you, to be president, you have to be of a certain faith, that to be elected to the Zoning Board of Appeals, you have to have a certain level of faith. This is all kind of shifting, but, you know, it's painful, clearly, for a lot of people. So, you know, transgender rights and the capacity of transgender people to be affirmed and accepted, I mean, that's just all part of the larger picture. But I'm impressed at the number of transgender people I know who have found an affirming and accepting church, and religion is exceptionally, and that community is exceptionally important to them.
That's great.
Because often these are people who haven't had the kind of family and social support that, you know, I might have had. So religion and churches and a faith community can be very positive. You know, not everyone is one of those crazy preachers from Texas who, you know, comes up with these horrific non-Christian proposals.
Right. No, it's true. So that's great. So we've just got a few minutes left, and do you have a question?
I had a caller that was curious about something, and I sent you over an email.
Oh.
And this person was calling, a caller from New London County was calling, and he's very interested in hormonal wash within the womb. Do you know anything about that? Apparently an exposure to different hormones in the womb may make the decision of transgender more?
There's obviously some complicated mechanism, and the research I read, which may not be something that came up last week, something goes awry. Maternal stress, could be some biochemical anomalies. I mean, the mechanism is apparently has to be very precisely timed and work just right. So, you know, any kind of extraneous perturbation, so to speak, can knock the thing off kilter. So I think it's, you know, unknown factors. Probably they'll figure it out eventually. The important issue is not so much the particular mechanism, but the idea that it's something that's happening at the neurobiological level rather than, you know, someone exhibiting a lifestyle choice or engaging in some perverse behavior.
So we've been speaking with Michelle Allison here on 91.7 FM WHUS Stores. This is Radio Naturopath. It's really terrific to have you here today. You've talked about so many issues, and you're so articulate, and you've brought a lot of things to light. It's really exciting. So we just have a couple of minutes left. Are there some things that you would like to leave us with, some words of wisdom?
I guess what I want to say is that this has all been pretty good for me, and I'm grateful to, you know, everyone who's been affirming and accepting, whether it's, you know, the clerk at J. Jill or, you know, the medical people I run into or the people at the grocery store or my many clients and certainly my excellent extended family and good friends. So and you all kind of fit in. This has been it's a pleasure to be in stores around this issue and in a lot of other things. It's not perfect here, but it is a place where I could be at Stores Center and feel exceptionally comfortable. I can be in Stop and Shop in Willimantic and be exceptionally comfortable.
I think we met there.
Yes, I got called out in the Stop and Shop parking lot.
Yes, you did.
Who is this person who knows who I am?
It was so exciting. I'm so happy that happened.
You're easily excited, Fran. That's
she
that's
is.
For sure.
It's all true.
It is
yes.
true.
Yes.
So I think I'm grateful. You know, gratitude is a good emotion to express. I'm grateful for a lot of things. My good health and my good fortune to have, you know, found myself at this stage of my life. And I just want everyone to know that the message is you're never too old. It's never too late to figure out something and make a bold move.
That's beautiful. So you've been listening to Radio Naturopath here at WHUS 91.7 FM. Our special guest was Michelle Allison, who is a marriage and family therapist in Storrs Mansfield, Connecticut. Her practice is located at 638 Browns Road in Storrs Mansfield, Connecticut. And if you're interested in reaching her, she can be reached at 860-451-9910. That's 860-451-9910. And I'm looking at the Psychology Today profile, but I want to go to your website, which is www. Well, it's still got your. I think that's right. I think
no,
it's
the new one should be up.
Oh, okay.
You're looking at an old page.
I guess I'm looking at old page. Yes, you're right. There it is. Got it. Okay, so. I think this is you. Is this Michelle Allison?
If you just Google Michelle Allison therapist Storrs. Stuff will show up.
You'll get it.
It will.
Right.
Stuff will show up.
The amazing Professor Google will come through for you. Yes.
Yes. Yes. Because Professor Google is being a little... Right. Okay. So right. Thank you so much for coming on today. This was extremely illuminating. It will be extremely helpful. If you only heard part of the show and would like to hear it again, it will be podcasted. It will be available in the next couple of days on www.whus.org. And you can also find this show on iTunes. So you've been listening to WHUS 91.7 FM, and we will be back. We'll be back live in 2 weeks for more Radio Naturopath here on WHUS 91.7 FM. Thank you for listening.